Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. And don't touch that dial, because tonight we've got a great show coming your way. Dr. Michael Barrett, N4ECW, the owner of Trans World Antennas, actually the creator of Trans World Antennas and the famous TW2010. It's coming up on WTWW right here on QSO. And welcome to QSO Live, which happens every Tuesday night at about 8 p.m. Central Daylight Time, or Central Time. And tonight, our co-host Frank Howell, we don't know where he is, do we, David?
He's done run off.
Well, I'm just hoping that we don't have to make bail by morning, okay? He's hosting a amateur radio club Christmas party. I'm just hoping that they all behave themselves. That's all. I'm just hoping that they all hang in there. Our guest tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is Dr. Michael Barrett, N4ECW. And we have a story for you this evening. Hello, Dr. Barrett. How are you?
Hello, Ted. And I thought I heard Matt in the background. And hello to your QSO listeners this evening.
No, actually, it's David in the background.
Good evening, sir.
I thought Matt.
Well, hello, David. You're starting to sound like Matt. I don't know what's going on up there.
Well, I want to say this. Of all the radio shows we've done, this is the clearest audio I've ever heard on you. Of course, you haven't seen what we've got in the studio either, so we're decked out in here. We've got, you just have to see it. We've got a new Axia console in here. We've got the NX12 phone system in here. It's bizarre. Plus, you're on a good landline, so it makes all the difference. So, but we're going to have a good time tonight on the phone.
Well, I was doing my Ted Rundle voice, so I thought that might be working.
Well, the announcement is this, and the folks have already heard it that are listening to the promos talking about Christmas carols. And what we're doing is we're playing Christmas music on WTWW. And the folks that send in pictures of their classic radios, we're going to have a grand prize drawing. We already announced that it was going to be a Trans World antenna, TW2010. And I think that's kind of blowing people away because they haven't heard anything about this antenna for so long. It's been around, but a lot of people have been busy, and I understand there was a gigantic, huge corporate takeover. And you are now the owner of Trans World Antennas again. The man that originated, the man that invented the antenna, is Gene Autry would say, back in the saddle again. So,
Ted, we've been around. I was looking back in the records, and we sold our first antennas in 2005. That's when the company was operating before then, but we spent some time doing R&D and prototyping. But we started selling antennas a decade ago. I owned the company and managed the company until about 3 years ago. It was bought by another fellow, good gentleman, a ham, Gary Archer, and late last week we got together and reached an agreement, and it wasn't, I hate to disappoint on the excitement, it wasn't a hostile takeover. It was a very friendly handover, Ted. But we've got some exciting things that are going to happen beginning right now and into the future. We've got a new line coming out. There's just a lot of things we can talk about. So I'm excited to be here and discuss Trans World Antennas.
Well, I thought I was going to hear a story of you and Gary in a, you know, like a big fist fight with hair pulling and all kind of. You got to know these guys here. No, I didn't know what you guys had come up with in terms of that, and that really doesn't matter because the both of you are still I guess I'm going to say you're still a team. But this antenna company, I think now with. You know, and you got to understand Dr. Barrett, his interests in things. He gets involved in a number of different businesses and things kind of switch around and whatnot, and the focus changes. and whatnot. So now you're in a position to where you can really roll up some sleeves and do some other things that you've probably always wanted to do, but at some point you just couldn't do it. And but now you can. So this
you're really on point on that one, Ted. I'm by nature, for lack of a better way of putting it, a serial entrepreneur. And I like to get things going and get them established and make them do well. And then I get bored and want to move on to something else and do something entirely different. Gary, on the other hand, he is what I would call a professional manager. He's got some financial accounting background. And Gary came in after I'd been in the company a few years. He actually took ownership of the company. He did some very good things, some things that needed to be done. The company was very solvent and doing well, but he made some modifications and tried some different things that really made the company go forward. Gary is a little older than I am, and he's in his got to be careful. He's in his golden years, and he wants to enjoy his golden years, so he's still going to be involved with us, but he's pretty much taking a back seat, and he's going to be available. But I'm going to take the best of what I did from the entrepreneurial standpoint, the best of what he did as a seasoned manager standpoint, and I'm going to go back in almost entrepreneur, not entrepreneur, but entrepreneur, back into the company, roll out some new things, shake up some things, and really go to market like we've never been to market before, Ted. That is the goal. That is the objective, the mission that I have for the company.
Well, you know, I'll from the listener's perspective or the radio amateur's perspective, the only thing they're wanting to know about is this antenna system. What is it? How does it work? Now, I'll tell you, the first time I ever saw this antenna, I had no idea what it was. I mean, I really didn't. I mean, I was walking by, and there's this thing on the back end of a... I was on the back end of a pickup truck or where it was. I was sitting on a table or something. I don't know. And I looked at that, and I said, what is that? And somebody said, that's a ham antenna. It was at a ham fest. And I'm trying to think of the one it was. It was the ham fest between here and Cookeville.
Silver Point,
yeah. And at that point, what's his Keaton? What's his? I can't remember his first name.
Jim Keaton. W4SOH.
Yeah, he was on the radio, and he was making all these DX contacts. And I did not connect the fact that the radio he was on was connected to this antenna. I didn't know what he was hooked up to. I just knew he was making one DX contact right after another. And so I kind of yelled at him. I said, where is the antenna system that you're, you know? And he pointed at the TW2010. And I said, that's what you're talking at? You know, he said, yes, that's what I'm talking about. Anyways, that impressed me. I thought, well, that's different because it's a different looking antenna. It doesn't look like anything that I had ever seen that was called an antenna. Okay. And I've seen some crazy things. I mean, guys make the stuff out of beer cans and everything out of the sun. But this thing was, to me, it kind of reminded me of a stealth military thing, you know, like something that you would see the government set up to do covert communication. I don't know. Does that make any sense at all? No, well, you know, it doesn't make it. I thought at least you'd go along with me. Well, okay.
Hey, I'm getting charmed by the platitudes here, Ted. I'm liking this.
Well, I was like, you know, this thing is jet black. Okay, this antenna is black, and it's like it looks like an H, on its side, or I guess is the best way to put it. It has a stand, sits close to the ground. Piece of coax coming off of it and another wire. In other words, you look at it, and I mean, it would be like something you would see, you know, a CIA operative come in, set up, and communicate to somebody, you know, halfway across the world with some secret mission is what you look at this, and that's what enters your mind. You think 007. And, but anyways, as time went on, I learned that the thing was not as mysterious as it looked, although it was kind of cool from the standpoint that it hides really good. And I know after you and I had been around a while, we'd done a lot of radio shows and talked about the TW2010, and I wound up owning one, and my son David and Matt, everybody had one, and we're all using these antennas and everything. And we decided we were going to try to photograph this thing, to take some pictures. Matter of fact, I don't know if it's still up there, but there should be a video of David putting this thing together. What? Yeah. Where were we? What was that beach he was on?
I do not remember.
Dr. Barrett, where was that? Where was the beach we were set up at and he was setting the antenna up and tearing it down?
Oh, man, that's years ago. It's still on YouTube. The video's still up there, and it has a clock on it to show how quickly it could be set up and taken down. But it was some beach somewhere, as the country song says.
Yeah, was that out at Sanibel?
I think it was.
I don't remember. I remember that. I remember the video. And by the way, folks, if you want to see it, go up to YouTube and put in what? Just Transworld Antennas or TW2010?
Yes,
there's one up there of, there was a video up there of Gary Archer putting it up. But you can tell Gary because, you know, Gary doesn't look as young as David, my son, does. And I was going to say.
With Gary's arthritis, it takes about 4 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes for him to set it up. But if it's cold weather and you want to get it up and down real quick, it's a couple of minutes to set up or tear down.
Well, I was going to say, go to YouTube and put in TW2010 or put in Transworld Antennas, and you'll see my son David. And I was going to say, for all you single ladies out there, take note of David because he's still single and eligible. So you watch that antenna going up real close and see what you think about that, and then shoot him an email. What do you think about that, Dr. Bear?
Well, hey, Ted, if he lands the girl, we'll throw in a give her a free TW2010 for a wedding gift.
There you go.
Well, if that isn't incentive enough, I don't know what is.
I'm telling you, that'll get it done.
Well, I guess the thing is, for the folks that are listening, if you go up and look at that YouTube video, the thing is, this is an unusual looking antenna. But the theory behind it is not all that unusual. What is good is the fact that this thing has already been put together. In other words, it's if you're going to do a little traveling and you want to travel across the country and you want to set up and operate, rather than having wires and insulators and all sorts of hokey-pokey stuff that you've got to fool around with, this thing comes in a carry bag. You unzip it. You pull this thing out. Set up the stand. Open it up, you'll see it on YouTube, and you're on. You're operating. Within 5 minutes, you're on the air. And as they used to say, well, I think it was either Bosco or Ovaltine, they would say, no muss, no fuss. And that's basically what you got. Today, hams are getting to the point where we're more and more, I should say we, but amateur radio operators are more and more appliance operators than they are builders and innovators. Not that we don't have builders and innovators. I think one of the things that's caused that is not because guys can't build or they can't go out to the beach or camping somewhere and pull wires up in trees and all that. What's created this is just a lack of time. You have a very, very narrow time window to operate on ham radio. So the time you've got, you want to spend operating. You know, not fussing around with an antenna system or trying to build something. You just want to set up and have fun, you know, and that's what this antenna is all about. Plus the fact, and if you're in a zoned area, this thing here is a godsend because it's invisible. What I was starting to say is we tried to take pictures of this thing. We had a heck of a time. I mean, you'd shoot a picture and you'd look at it and you'd see the antenna, but it was like it wasn't really there. It was like you didn't really have a picture of this thing. You couldn't capture it. People looking at the photograph would see it, but it just didn't stand out. It was like subliminal, you know. So we had to fool with it, putting it in all different kinds of environments to get a good picture of it because it just hides. Wherever you put it, it's just hidden, you know. And that was a good thing. So the idea of the fact that it's stealth and you don't have I guess I'm going to say you don't have the backyard neighbor association with their binoculars looking over at you. They may see it, but they may not see it even though they see it. So anyhow, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. It's All About Ham Radio, and our guest today, Dr. Michael Barrett of Trans World Antennas. We'll be right back with Dr. Barrett right after this. R&L Electronics. Now listen, go to their website and look at what they've got. Talk about ideas. They've got towers, radio accessories. They have HF radios, VHF radios, UHF radios. They've got power supplies. They've got connectors. They've got coax and cable. They've got books on amateur radio. They've got amateur radio tuners, antenna tuners, I should say, automatic and manual. They've got antenna mounts. They've got all sorts of antenna accessories, along with antennas themselves. And they also have big amplifiers, and they have medium-sized amplifiers, and they've got preamps, and they've got used equipment, and they've got all the major brand names like Kenwood, Yaesu, ICOM, Alinco, you name it. It's all there at R&L Electronics. Now, another thing, they carry used items. Radios that have been previously owned that are in mint condition. They've got the new Yaesu System Fusion Mobile. Their phone number is 1-800-221-7735. Now, I'll give that to you in just a minute. But just remember, folks are happy when they deal with R&L Electronics. They're great on service. They're courteous. They get the item out quickly to you. And if you have any problems at all, these folks are right on top of it. Now, once again, their phone number is 1-800-221-7735. 1-800-221-7735. Or go to Google and just Google R&L Electronics. That's R&L Electronics. And mention WTWW when you call. Here at QSO, we hear success story after success story. We hear excited people telling us they just got their ticket using Ham Test Online. That's right. This is the easiest, most concise, as well as fastest method to get that ticket in your hand. Ham Test Online. No thick books to read, no DVDs, no CDs to wade through, no studying for hours and hours and then forgetting what you studied, and no irrelevant information that you have to wade through in order to get to the things that are really on the test. Ham Test Online. Now, if you've already upgraded to Extra Class and you no longer need the services of Ham Test Online, we want you to think about this. Ham it forward. That's right. Ham it forward. Now, what is that? There's a lot of folks out there that would like to Elmer someone into the hobby, but you're not quite sure how to do it. Don't know if you could really tackle the project. There's folks out there that would like to teach a class of maybe three or four people or maybe larger, but you see that as a real undertaking. Don't know if you can quite handle that. Working with someone and getting them their ham ticket is one of the most satisfying things that you could do as a radio amateur and promote this hobby, moving it forward with new blood. That's why we have Ham It Forward. Now, this is a cooperative effort from the QSO radio show and the folks at Ham Test Online. All you have to do is get a subscription for a new prospective ham, and then just follow through with them a little bit and let Ham Test Online take them through the steps and get their ticket painlessly, easy, and fun. Keep this in mind. It's a new program. We're calling it Ham It Forward. We'd love for you to participate in this. Everybody knows someone that they would love to get into the hobby. Give a gift. Give the gift of the ham radio, amateur radio hobby by Ham It Forward. Go to hamtestonline.com. That's hamtestonline.com. Or look on the QSORadioshow.com website. You've heard us talk about the CC Skywave radio. And the only way you can do this radio justice is you have to hold one in your hand. You have to own it. You have to be able to take it out in the backyard or take it, slip it in your pocket as you travel around. It's a beautiful travel radio. Probably the best travel radio that you could possibly ever want to own. Okay, it's got AM on it, a very hot AM radio section. FM, FM stereo. It's got Weather Alert Plus. It's also got the shortwave bands, 2.3 to 26.1 megahertz continuous tuning. And it also has the Air Aviation Band. You have direct entry of frequencies and plus auto scan and store. Can you believe that? A lighted LCD display, selectable fast or fine tuning on all bands except weather. There are 400 memory presets on this radio, and it runs on two AA alkaline batteries, all right, and it runs forever. There's a stereo headphone jack and a fold-out backstand. Of course, you've seen those. The clock with 12 or 24-hour format. The alarm that's on it as well. And there's a rotary volume knob, which is kind of cool. I hate the knobs you have to push on them, you know, and turn the volume up and down. It comes with high-quality CC buds, the earphones, and a carrying case along with a one-year warranty. Now, you can order the SkyWave radio right now. To order, all you have to do is call 1-800-522-8863. That's 1-800-522-8863. Or visit them at ccrane.com. You have to mention WTWW. And the reason why we want you to do that is Bob Crane wants to know that you're supporting him as he brings you Midnight in the Desert, the Art Bell Show, as well as some of the music programming we have here on WTWW. Once again, the phone number 1-800-522-8863. That's 522-8863. Or go to ccrane.com and be sure and mention WTWW. It's the CR1A. Now you say, what's the CR1A? CR1A is a software-defined radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this thing does not need a computer. It's totally self-contained. And it's a little bitty toot. It sets on the desktop. It, as far as ham radio is concerned, it does 160 through 10. International broadcast bands, it does 120 through 11. AM, single sideband, CW. You know, I can't get into all of the features, but for example, on VHF, it goes from 64 to 260 megahertz. UHF from 437 to 512. FM broadcast band. Oh, my goodness. You know, I don't want to try to describe this radio. You have to see it. It does the aircraft band. You know, there's a Marine and NOAA. It does the public service bands. It's a software-defined radio without the computer. It's self-contained, and it's small. It's slick-looking, and you just have to check it out. Check out the CR1A. Com Radio. Go to comradio.com. That's C-O-M-M radio, comradio, one word, .com. Check out the CR1A. And when you contact them, mention WTWW. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website, it's simply QSOradioshow.com, and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. You're listening to the QSO Radio Show, and it's all about ham radio. And now back to our guest, Dr. Michael Barrett with Trans World Antennas. What I would like to do, though, is I'd like for you to start in a little bit in regards to the creation of this thing. How did you come up with it? Where'd the idea come from and the theory behind it?
Well, Ted, let me correct one thing, and it's just a matter of nomenclature. Let me change the word from inventing the antenna to creating the antenna. If you go look in the books on antenna theory that have been written over the last 60, 70 years, there is a design, the modified H design, which is the pattern for this antenna. So the actual, the modified H has been around for a long, long time, but it was only went so far. What we did was we did a couple of things. We created the logarithm that would make it be more squatty. Instead of being like a gigantic capitali that would go up, you know, 16 feet into the air, we made the thing somewhere without the stand, somewhere around 6.5 feet tall. And we made the arms wider, and we made the center section shorter so it would even be more stealthy. We went with black powder coating to be able to hide the thing. And what we did invent is correct on this, when you get past the structure, we made the array box and the control box so it would be a five-band antenna. Basically, the antenna is a center-fed vertical dipole. Now, I even have broadcast engineers that want to talk to me about it being a compromise antenna, and I ask them, how can a half-wave dipole be a compromise antenna? And we always start out with that discussion. But if you can think of a center-fed dipole strung horizontally, what a modified H is, it's a flip of that vertically, and the top arm and the bottom arm become capacitance. They provide capacitance for the antenna system, and we made an array box that has induction coils, wire coils inside, and we use relays, 12-volt relays, to add or reduce the amount of electrical length of that antenna by adding or taking out coils. So basically, you get five antennas in one. You get 10-meter, 12, 15, 17, and 20-meter on the same structure. And it is truly a half-wave vertical dipole on those bands. The SWR is low. The antenna is easy. It weighs 21 pounds, Ted, with the, you know, when you ship it or when you carry it in the carrying case or where you mount it. Permanently, it's a 21-pound antenna. It can stand about 100-mile-an-hour surface winds. If it gets 100-mile-an-hour in where you live, you're going to have more problems than this antenna falling over. Doesn't that? So all these things are good. We've determined that the modified H design gave an extremely low takeoff angle. And the secret sauce is this, and it's really good secret sauce. It's like the KFC secret recipe or the sauce that used to go on the old Shoney's Big Boy or on the Big Mac also. The low takeoff angle, Ted, puts the maximum signal toward the horizon until it hits the curvature of the earth. Then it goes skyward. So you get your maximum bounce, you get your maximum signal strength on your first bounce. Well, everybody that does DX knows that if you go up strong, you come down strong, and you get other hops. So that first hop is real critical, and it is a tremendous DX antenna on 10 through 20 meters. We make a 40-meter antenna that's a heck of a DX antenna, too, because of the low takeoff angle. It's also, the 40 meter works well on NVIS, and if you fold the arms up and make them like an inverted V, it really works NVIS on 40 meter. It's very strong. But that is the magic of the antenna. It's small, it's stealthy, it's lightweight, it's easy to set up and take down. If you mount it permanently in the yard, the arms fold up and you can mow under it. It doesn't require any ground radials. We tried it in R&D. I put down 48 ground radials. It didn't make a bit of difference. Ground radials are irrelevant. Now, if you set it near salt water, you do get some good conductivity with the salt water, and you have. But I think that's as much that you don't have any obstruction going toward the horizon as anything. Ground radials, not necessary. an amplifier, Ted, is really not necessary on 10 through 20 meter when you use our antenna. You don't get that much more bang for your buck when you throw a bunch of extra RF into the mix. So it's really served us well. We're really, it's been around for a long time. Most of the way we sell the antenna is word of mouth and through, you know, QSO. And we've sold, I think, according to the records, about 4,000 of these antennas in the last decade.
Now, when you say the thing does well near saltwater, can you like put an old bathtub in the backyard and fill it full of Epsom salts and water? Will that get you into the contest?
I haven't tried that, but I was hoping to find somebody that had a saltwater swimming pool that would mount the thing somewhere on a little island or something right in the middle of their swimming pool and have them tell me if that made any difference. But we've had it out on boat. We've done a mobile marine, and I couldn't run 40 meter and 80 meter on the boat. There was so many, it sounded like a total de-expedition on just about every frequency. So I couldn't do 40 and 80 on a mobile marine. We were out in the Caribbean, outside of Key West. But you know, it does really well on salt water. I mean, it's a great antenna for that if you live near the beach. But otherwise, it's comparable to a beam at about 60 feet, Ted. Now you know you can have a lot of radios on a beam, and it's directional, and you can get a better incoming signal, maybe 1 to 2 S units. It'll compete favorably with any wire you put up, and it hears as good as it is on the other end. If you ever got around somebody that has one, find out somebody that has a TW2010, ask them about it, or go be the control operator on their station for a few hours, and you'll really be sold on the antenna. It is what it is, Ted. I have a lot of respect for a lot of companies out there that do ham radio equipment and antennas. It's not a stepper, but it also is not a $2,500 antenna with a $2,500 tower and probably a $1,000 rotor. So for what you get, the price you pay, and the performance, I don't have a problem, hyping it or talking about it or promoting it to anybody, Ted.
I was going to ask a question about antenna height. Now, this thing, for the most part, it sits on the ground, and it sits on a tripod or a, what do you call the thing?
We call it a ground pole or a mounting pole. You can put it in the bottom arms have to be about at least 2 feet off the ground, between 2 feet, 24 and 30 inches. So we provide offer a ground pole that you can put in the ground and mount it permanently. Some people that put it on their patio, they take a 5 gallon bucket of concrete, and they stick the mounting pole down in it, and they hack it off, to where it'll be 2 feet above the patio, the bottom arms, and they use a 5 gallon bucket of concrete. Other people put it out in the yard, and they mow under it, and some people just use a stand, Ted, where they set it up and leave it set up on the patio, where they'll take it out and set it up in the yard and move it back and forth. So it depends on the operating conditions, what works best.
Well, if you want that thing out of the way, let's say you say, it's nice, I can set it down in the backyard and it works, let's say you want it out of the way. So you say, let's put this thing up on the roof and get it out of the way so I can run my, how does it perform on the roof of a house?
We've tested it on all kind of roofs. In fact, I had one of the companies that I owned had a huge metal building with a metal roof on it, and we mounted it on the roof. It will work well elevated. You can put it on a tower, you can put it on a roof. Now, physics get a little bit involved. If you put it on a tower, it has to be at least a quarter wave above the ground. Now, there's some PhD physicists that will explain why that is, but take my word for it. So a quarter wave on 20 meters is, you know, that's 5 meters, so it has to be about 16, 17 feet off of the ground. If it's any lower than that, it degrades performance. So it either has to be mounted about 2 feet off the ground, the bottom arms, or it has to be mounted a minimum of a quarter wave on 20 meters. So that's about 17, 18 feet. I always tell everybody 20 feet. If you're setting it on a roof or on a chimney on a roof, you're in pretty good shape. But a lot of people put on a tire away from the house, and you got to follow those guidelines. Now, with that said, on 10-meter ground wave, you do get better performance because you're not going skyward, and you've got the elevation to go point to point. So it does, if you're just talking local hams on 10-meter, you know, 50, 60, 100 miles away, you get some better performance with it up in the air. As far as the DX performance, unless you've got tremendous amount of cover or structure or buildings real close to where you're mounting, meaning within 20, 30 feet, you're not going to see much improvement in performance. I've had one on 60 feet high on a tower, and I've had one mounted in the yard, and I would flip a B-switch back and forth on 17-meter, on 20-meter, and the party on the other end couldn't tell any difference. But some people just want it up out of the way, and they want it on the roof, hooked to the chimney, or on, you know, on a tower somewhere, and it'll work that way. But if you can't afford that or don't want to do that, then sitting on the ground gets equally good performance.
Well, that was one of the reasons why I was asking is I was wondering why or asking because if it's on the roof, it makes a great citizen's band antenna. So a lot of people in the shack want to have a CB radio hooked up. I mean, they just do. They're hams. Some of them came up through citizen's band, but a lot of them would still like to have a citizen's band rig in the shack, and they'd like to have an antenna on it that would operate, especially if you're getting into an emergency situation or some sort of a local thing. So anyhow, with that in mind, with the antenna on the roof, it's a great citizen's band antenna. But there's another little
anomaly. Let me give you a trans world secret that I don't even know if you know this or not.
No, wait a minute. See, you interrupted me here. You know, and
okay,
and,
go ahead.
And forget, I've got the volume control where you are.
Okay.
I wouldn't do that to you. Oh, yes, I would. Anyways, no, what I was going to say, if it's on the roof, and if you're looking at it as using it as a local antenna for citizens band, it also does an incredible job on 2 meters. Now, I don't know if that was the secret you were about to tell, but I was going to let that out of the bag.
I was going to talk about 2 meter and 70 centimeter FM. It's outstanding on those bands. And on 6 meter, it has about a 3-to-1 SWR on 6 meter. So with a tuner, it's an outstanding antenna for 6 meter FM. So yeah, you preempted me, Ted. You stole my thunder.
Well, I was going down the road, and then you interrupted me. See, I was kind of excited about that because I remember the TW2010 being up on the roof and switching over to the 2 meter band and comparing it to another antenna we had on the roof that was specifically for 2 meters, and the TW2010 was getting better signal reports. Now, I will say this, it's a little directional. It kind of has a pattern to it, where if you're used to an omnidirectional, it won't be exactly the same. But in the areas, I guess I want to say overall, where you have what you would consider to be a null or a minimum, it still was doing better than the straight vertical that I had. And I don't know why that is, because I get lost on VHF propagation. That's an area that I don't quite understand. I don't understand when you can put an antenna on the ground on VHF and get just as far as you can with it elevated. I've witnessed this several times. It's kind of a weird oddity, but so I don't.
Let me interject something. I got to do a disclaimer here, Ted, before somebody buys one and says it don't work worth a darn on sideband. As you well know, being an engineer that you are in radio, there's an issue on VHF and UHF with something called polarization. Generally, on 2 meter and 440, and even 6 meter to an extent, people will do phone on FM vertically and do weak signal or sideband polarized horizontally. This antenna will be polarized vertically. When you change from vertical polarization to horizontal polarization on VHF or UHF, you get some pretty decent dB loss. I mean, you may lose 2 or 3 S units going from one to the other, which doesn't really happen at 10 meter and above. But on those VHF and UHF frequencies, the antenna's great on FM when you're talking vertical. You're using vertical polarization. If you want to put up our antenna and talk 2 meter sideband, it's really not good for that. You would be better using a small beam or a we call them a squalo or a halo. So I wanted to make that clear. There's polarization issues when you get down on those, when you get to the VHF and UHF bands.
Well, I just guess I was using it for local vertical 2 meter communication. I never tried it on 70 centimeters. I have no idea what it does up there, but I did try it on 2 meters. I was kind of amazed that it worked. So
let me give you one of the war stories, and I'll try to limit them to a very minimum. About 5 or 6, 7 years ago, I don't know. It's been more than 5 years ago. I was staying at the Peabody Hotel in Orlando, Florida, and I was up about the 5th floor, and I had a balcony. The room I had a balcony. You could go out and sit under an umbrella and eat fast food or whatever you brought, have a picnic. Well, I set one up there, and I worked. It's about, I guess, 90 to 100 miles from Orlando to the Gulf and Orlando to the Atlantic. I worked simplex stations all the way from the Atlantic side of the state to the Gulf side of the state, and I thought, wow, this thing is working great, simplex on 2 meter. And then I had a station call me from Fort Lauderdale, and I spoke to a station in Fort Lauderdale. I hadn't run the software on it, but I'm convinced, based on just knowing about vertical antennas, you know, for VHF, for 2 meter, I'm of the opinion that there's considerable gain to be had because of the electrical length of the antenna on VHF and UHF. It really performed, and that was my own personal experience. I have people write all the time, and they'll send me messages on Facebook or emails or leave a message on the website, and they give similar experiences. So, you know, if you only have to have one antenna and you want to work DX, and you want to work the local repeaters or simplex on 70 centimeter and 2 meter, it'll do the job for you, Ted, as you know.
I was going to say, you've taken to the road with this antenna, or you've taken to the boat or the air. I don't know. You kind of all over the place with this antenna, and you've done the equivalent of some one-man D expeditions, and I don't know what all else. But I want you to talk about that a little bit, because I know there was one time you were somewhere on an island somewhere, and somebody told me, they said, get on such and such a frequency. Dr. Barrett set up and all that. So I set up and I got on there. We talked. It was like you were local. I don't know where you were. You were somewhere on an island.
That's another war story that happened. On October the 10th of 2010, half of the island of St. Martin is divided into half of it's owned by the French government, and half of it was owned by the Dutch government, by the Netherlands. The Netherlands side, the Dutch declared that part of the island to be its own independent entity, and the Independence Day for them was 10-10-10. Well, Joe Pater, W8GEX and his bunch set up a station. I believe the call sign was PJ7E. it was reported in DX Magazine and other things. I knew all that. I happened to be down there, but I was staying on the French side. I was vacationing, and I was setting up and doing kind of a one-man de-expedition on the French side. So I had up a 2010, and they were on the Dutch side, and they were talking, and everybody was already in that direction wanting to work, you know, PJ7A. So I was working stations on 17 meters and on 12 meters because those are 12 meters particularly tough to get you, you know, get your DXCC on. Well, the station that were working me told Joe Pater and his bunch said, hey, you guys need to get you a TW2010. That guy on the other side of the island, he's a lot lighter than you are. The joke was that they set up, and they had a 2010. They didn't put it up. They were using wires, and I think they had a hex beam and some other things. So they go pull out the bag and set up a TW2010 and start working stations with the 2010. The reason I knew this was on the way back, I flew from St. Martin to Charlotte, North Carolina, back to Nashville. Well, those guys got on the airplane in St. Martin. They looked over and saw me, recognized me, and Joe did, and we started talking, and they started telling me the war story. We had our picture taken when we landed with all of us in the U.S. Air terminal there in Charlotte. And it became a great story, so they became believers. And when they go on a de-expedition now, they make sure they put up a 2010 in their a cadre of antennas, Ted. So that's the story you're talking about.
I just remember talking to you, and I was kind of amazed. At first, I didn't think you really were where you said you were. You know, because there wasn't at that point in time there was no pileup or anything like that around you. You know, you were just there. I think maybe you'd already, you know, completed pileup operations and had moved to a different frequency unannounced, you know, and I think that's one of the reasons why it went down like that. I can't remember who it was. Maybe Jim Keaton called me and said, get on such and such a frequency, you know, and I did. And then we had a good QSO on whatever band it was. I don't know, maybe it was 17 meters.
Probably either 12 or 17. I was working about, we were there for, I think, almost 2 weeks, and I would get on about 2 hours a day, what I would call pre-gray line, because once it started getting dark, about 30 minutes before dark, the mosquitoes would come out, and they were big as hummingbirds, so I wouldn't stay on there after that. So I would be on there for a couple hours, and I would be on those bands, and I would tell everybody, I'll be back on tomorrow night, you know, same time, same general frequency. And I was on in a villa on Orient Beach on the French side, and I had printed 5,000, 2,500 QSL cards printed twice, and I've run out of them. Responding to everybody that sent a card that was in the log, and everything, I sent out 5,000 QSL cards for that period of time, Ted, that 10 days that I spent on the radio in St. Martin. And it got so crowded, the pileups were so great, I had to not only do it by call sign district, but I had to do it by continent. I had to say, you know, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, Asia, Africa, South America. It was unlike anything I'd ever been a part of before, but conditions were good. I was in a good location. I had a good antenna, ha-ha, and it worked out for me, and it was a great experience. Now, I went down there, and we've set up everywhere. We've been in the Caribbean. We've been to the Yellowstone Park and Grand Teton, and we love traveling and setting up just to see what kind of performance we can get, but boy, I can tell you, if you're going to be on the radio like that, have another operator with you. I did have a logger. K1ECW was logging my XYL, but it was a lot of work to be the only operator on a deal like that.
Well, I guess you just get overwhelmed by the number of stations calling in. You know, I've often wondered, from the standpoint of being on a de-expedition and dealing with just this constant pile-up thing. I mean, does it? I know there's an excitement of working all those stations, but doesn't it get? I don't know. I mean, get a little tedious of this. Well, you're 599. You know, you hear this constantly. You know, 599, 599, and but there's no conversation. You know, there's not much conversation. And I would think after a while, it'd start to get a little. You know, your head would start to get a little antsy. You know, from. Just a, you know, and you, and when you let up on the button, you got 12 people calling at the same time. I don't think I would like that. I'm too much of a rag chewer, you know.
one of the things that I did, and it wasn't an official D expedition like, you know, the guys that go to Howard Island or somewhere. This was a Dr. Barrett D expedition, a one man expedition with a logger. But I would do it both ways, Ted. If somebody made the call, I responded to, you know, to the call, and they wanted to talk a little bit, I would talk to them. It didn't matter to me if there was, you know, 500 people waiting to work my station. If the guy wanted to talk a little bit, I would talk to him. On the other hand, if somebody, all they wanted was the, you know, the signal report and confirmation, I would give them that, and I'm sure that there were some folks that were really wanting to make the contact, that really need the contact on one of the warp bands, that wished I would quit talking to these guys and just work your stations. Well, it was my de-expedition, and I was going to work it in. If a guy wanted to talk to me, I would talk to him. The other thing I would tell you, and people who have been on them realize this, people that haven't get frustrated. The issue is, who do I acknowledge? You've got strong stations. You've got weak stations. You've got differences in voice, tonal quality. There's no rhyme or reason to who I would pull out of the pileup. Sometimes I'd pull the strong station. Sometimes I'd pull the weakest station. Sometimes I'd pull the first one that keyed. Sometimes it was the last one that keyed. I don't know what other people do to pick somebody, but I just at random pick somebody. But boy, when there's hundreds of people in there calling, it you've got to have some ears that can really zero in on a call, or you'll really get nervous and frustrated.
Well, you've also done a number of special event stations with this antenna. And I think you've also been present when there's been special event stations using it. And that, of course, would entail not just, you know, somebody DX calling you, but people all over the United States. And from a stateside standpoint, how has it fared up in circumstances like that where you're running a special event station and you got people from all 50 states wanting to log you?
It's fairly similar. It depends on the conditions of the band. Sometimes, you know, the skip or the propagation is short, so that determines a lot of it. Sometimes it's always the West Coast, or it could be depending on the time of year. You could have the North South trans-equatorial propagation, they call it. So sometimes it's Ohio and Michigan and Canada. In that direction. So the time of year and propagation determines a lot of it, but we generally, on a special event, it's usually a Saturday sometimes it's a Sunday afternoon, but for the most part, we're able to work everybody that wants to work us, and the stations are so strong when you're in the U.S., that you don't get many from Europe. Occasionally you'll get some European stations or South American stations, but we did, remember you promoted one time and you had the professor, Dr. Michael Birdwell from Tennessee Technological University on, who was the foremost scholar on Alvin C. York. And we did, I think it was the 90th anniversary of his capturing the 132 Germans and in France in World War One, and we gave away some knives, and we had a special event. We did that. We have done, I haven't in the last few years because I hadn't been as involved. But before that, I wouldn't be afraid to say we did 200 special events, and they were all extremely successful, and we really enjoyed them.
Well, let me ask you a question here. We'll switch gears. For those of folks out there that don't know anything about you at all, they hear you talking and they know you're tied up with this antenna system. Like, you know, you don't want to be called the inventor. You want to be called the creator. I don't know. Anyways, let's start here and ask this question. When is the first time that you ever heard the term ham radio? When is the first time you actually ever saw an amateur station set up with somebody operating it?
I was about 8 years old, and there was a ham, and I'm going to try to remember his call sign. The gentleman's name was John Stacy Fite, and John was an electrical engineer for Middle Tennessee Electric Company, and he was in Watertown, Tennessee. The company, the headquarters of the membership corporation, was in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. He was the only ham that in the little town that I knew of or anybody knew of. He went around with this huge monstrosity, looked like a bedpost on his car, and he had these little antennas all over it, and he looked like he was one of these really weird kind of people, because nobody else had anything like that. And John got me interested in listening to radio. I'd had a lot of surgeries, and I was housebound a lot, and I listened to a lot of shortwave. I listened to ham radio, and I actually got a novice ticket. Don't ask me what my call was, Ted, because that's almost 50 years ago. I can't remember. But I do remember, I believe it was either a year or 2 years, and you had to upgrade. I did not upgrade at that point. But I always wanted to be a ham. I had a little problem with the code, being able to hear the code. Now, as I got older, I passed the code and, you know, got my HF license and everything. But in those days, it was a significant chore to become a general class operator and do the Morse code. So that kind of kept me back for a long time. But it was a great joy to me as I guess a housebound person, having had polio and had a lot of surgeries. I just enjoyed listening. And as I could listen to phone, and I played and worked on trying to learn the code and everything. And, of course, in those days, Ted, you didn't have the electronics you got now. You know, I had three black and white TV stations and an AM radio and once-a-week county newspaper, and that was it. So that was the first recollections I had of ham radio.
Well, I guess I was asking because, but this started with this fella. You named his name, but he was this the first time you'd actually seen somebody operate, or did you just see his station, or did he, you know, I guess I want to say, sit down and talk to you and try to Elmer you through this, or how did that work, or did you wind up self-Elmering?
Well, he would come and see me. His wife was a music teacher at the local school. He would stop by and see me. He would bring me the books. There was a company that's been out of business forever in Nashville. You may remember it. It was called Electra Distributing Company.
Oh, yeah.
And they did ham equipment, and they sold Collins and everything else. And that's where you'd get all the books. Well, he would get books for me, and he would mentor me in the sense of encouraging me and stop by. When I was able, I would go over to his house and watch him operate. And he took a great interest in me and encouraged me. I grew up and I got in high school, and I guess like David and Matt and everybody else, you too, I started getting interested in girls and sports, and started traveling around a little bit, going, you know, with the sports team. So being the manager and a statistician and everything. So it wasn't as important in those years of my life. Then later on in life, after I got married, started having a family, I picked it back up and became extremely interested in me. But John was, if you recall, Ted, now, and you have to speak up because you've been a ham a lot longer than I have, but a general class operator could give the novice test without the FCC involvement. I mean, now we have the volunteer examining system and all that, but back then, a general class operator could give a novice test and grant you privileges to use code. You couldn't use phone, but you could use code, and that's what he did for me.
I guess the thing that I was thinking about too, and that is, you were always, I guess I want to say, scholastically inclined. You know, you were a person that did a lot of reading and a lot of studying. And so I wondered if that made it, was it, yuck, because back during the time, and I don't know when you took the test, but when I took it, you had to go down to the, I went to the Detroit Federal Building. And I wound up getting there just a little bit late, so I got the seat way back, you know, in the room. And then the code generator machine was way up at the front. And they had marble walls and glass all the way around, and of course the hard marble floor. So it rang like Mammoth Cave. And they turned that code tape machine on. It was like a perforated paper tape that went through this thing. At least that's what I think it was, but that's what it looked like. Anyhow, they were doing the code, and it was really hard to distinguish because of this big, huge echo in the room, you know. And but that was all part of it. In other words, you had to do 13 words a minute for the general class, and then of course pass the theory. But of course now that went away. I think a lot of folks have they don't want to realize what an ordeal that was, because there was all this pressure on the person taking the test. You just felt so I don't know, intimidated by it, I guess is the best way to put it. And I was talking to a friend of mine here in town. His name was Watt, and he told the story, and it was exactly the way it was in the Detroit office where we took our test, and that is the examiner would call out your name in front of everyone, you know, and he would say, Michael Barrett, you have failed. And, you know, everybody in the room would just, you know, they just, you know, and on the other hand, had you passed the tests or the test, he'd call you to the front. He would say, Michael Barrett, could you come up here, please? And, you'd get up to the desk, and then he would, he'd kind of put his head out toward you, and you'd lean down toward him. You know, he'd say, you have passed.
And then, oh my!
When I talked to Watt, he said they did exactly the same thing where he took the test. You know, so I thought that must have been some sort of a, I don't know, intimidation tactic of some kind. You know, to get you. I don't know, but that, I just know when they yelled out, "You have failed!" All these people in the classroom, you know, they were ready to, or the test room, I should say, they want to crawl under the desks. You know, it was like they wanted to go hide somewhere. But
when I took, I can't beat that story, Ted. I can only give you one for me that was a little close to that. In the day, let's say back in the day, the same written test for the technician or the general, it was the same test, and you got upgraded based on your code skills. So I went to, I don't mind telling where it was, I went up to Rockwood. You know where Rockwood Harriman is. I guess it's probably 100 miles east of Nashville or about 70 miles west of Knoxville, Tennessee. I go in, and there's a room full of people. And I take the test, and they collect them all. So they came around, and they said, you passed. They said, you passed, you can leave. So me and one other fella, they dismissed us. I mean, they didn't sit around and talk to us. These were volunteer examiners now. These were not FCC people. And they shuffled us out of the room. And I thought, Well, you know, everybody else is in there. Why'd they keep all those people in there to, you know, social? They must be locals they're socializing with or whatever. So finally, one of the examiners came out and said, look, you two guys are the only two that passed. These other guys didn't pass. We're gonna talk to them and give them some tips and work with them. But that's why we let you out, because we've got to let these guys down easy. So, I mean, these were serious examiners, Ted. They had on the shirts, they had on the patches, they had witnesses there. They meant business. This was in the earlier days of the volunteer examiner program. But I thought that I had just been dismissed because I wasn't from up in Roan County. And luckily, I passed that test, and probably 25 people did not pass. So it may be easier now to review the questions and get on Ham Test Online and do well. And it is, that is a good program, by the way. I'm going to pitch them, Ted. Ham Test Online is a good program. It's been hard over the years to get a ham license, and it took a lot of work. And for people that went through what you went through and what I went through, what others have gone through over the years, you're kind of proud of the fact that you were able to accomplish that.
Well, we had something similar happen. David, I don't know if you can tell the story, but David and Matt and Holly all went to test at the same time at this test center. And there was a gentleman, which we will not mention him by name.
Right.
But he, I don't know, he was just antagonistic toward David and Matthew for some reason.
Well, he was. And then he even told Matthew that he hadn't passed. You know, and he took great pride in telling him that. You know, but Matthew did pass. You know, so kudos to him.
Well, yeah, but you didn't tell the story as to how all that transpired.
Well, it's
Well, then, supposedly he's giving me a blank look, but I'll tell you, he's got a lot of those blank looks. If you're looking for a blank look, ask him a question. Anyways, they had taken the test, and Matt had he knew he had aced it, you know. So this guy comes along and said, "Well, you've failed the test," and he took, like David said, he took great pride in telling him that and making it very public, almost like the guys in Detroit or whoever took his. So Matt knew otherwise, you know, and I don't think he took to the fact that this guy was deriving so much pleasure from it. So he questioned. He said, "No, I don't believe that." And so the guy had to go get the answer key. I guess it fits over the test page, or however they do it. And when he went to get the answer key, when he came back, he then realized that it was the fellow sitting either behind or in front of Matt that had failed, and that Matt had indeed had passed. So that was a little rough going down for this guy, you know, because he had to admit that he had made a mistake.
Oh, my.
But Matt was adamant. He said, "No, I know for a fact I passed this test," you know. And so that was kind of a, you know, so the volunteer examiner program is cool, you know, as long as personalities, I guess I want to say, don't get involved in it, if that makes any sense, because that was kind of a, that was quite an ordeal. I mean, when he came in and said that, and everybody was just, you know, they all just sank. They thought, how did Matt not pass this, you know? And he was so sure of himself. If Matt had not been assertive, they would have sent him on his way as a fail. You know, and that's just strange. One of those weird things. It always happens to us, you know. If it's a weird thing, it happens to us. Here's something else I want to do. I'd like to go down this road. I'd like folks to get acquainted with you. Folks that maybe have heard you on the air in the past, but we got a big crowd now. We got a large number of brand new hams that are listening, that listen to QSO and the QSO live show. I want you to share with us, not from a bragging standpoint, but I want you to share with us your educational background. And the reason why is because I want folks to understand that where this antenna comes from is from somebody that does quite a little bit of reading and thinking and has got a great educational background. But talk about that a little bit.
Oh, Ted, you always about once every 2 or 3 years you'll do this to me. I can give you the schools and also the degrees, but they're in Lebanon, Tennessee, Cumberland University. I have a 2-year degree in mathematics and science from them, from back way in the 70s, and I have a degree in industrial engineering and technology from Middle Tennessee State University. They do not have an engineering school at Middle Tennessee. They have an industrial studies and technology school. I have a degree from them that's got an electromechanical emphasis. Did work on the industrial relations degree there. Have a degree in counseling from Andrew Jackson University. Have a law degree and practiced law for many years. The law degree is from Samford University in Birmingham. It used to be Howard College, and years ago they changed the name to Samford, name it after Frank Park Samford, an insurance executive who donated a lot of money to the school. But Cumberland School of Law was in Lebanon. Howard University bought it in the 60s, moved it to Birmingham, and I got my law degree there. Then I have a doctorate from Bethany Seminary that also carries a major in economics and in law because of previous degrees. And I like 6 hours having a master's in hospital administration. And after all that, I went back to over to MTSU and did work on and earned a Bachelor of Science in electronic media production. So I really never could figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up, Ted. So I did a lot of things and enjoyed it. And one of these days I'll figure out what I want it to be when I grow up. And it might be retired. I don't know.
Well, the other thing too, and I don't think I've ever put you on the spot or touched on this, but I think it's important to touch on it because of the fact that it's an inspirational thing to so many people that come in contact with you, but Dr. Barrett has spent the majority of his life navigating from a wheelchair. And I want you to tell that story a little bit, because I know there's two people I think about when I think I'm getting a rough deal, okay? I think about Dr. Barrett, and I think about Ronnie Millsap. You know, I mean, if you've ever been to Ronnie's house, he'll go up the steps. He never turns the lights on, even if it's 2 o'clock in the morning. It's stone dark everywhere you go in there. You know, but here are folks that, you know, they don't just get up in the morning and do everything you do the way you do it. It's a challenge every day when they do get up. So I want you to talk about this a bit, because what you've accomplished in your life leaves all of the rest of us without any excuses at all.
Ted, I was born in 1957, January of 1957. My next birthday, I'll be 59 years old. Jonas Salk had discovered that by injecting the weakened polio virus into a person, that it would provide immunity, a great deal of immunity from the polio virus. Now, folks that are our age and older will remember the polio epidemics of the 40s and 50s, and it ravaged. It was as bad as cancer in our day and time. Polio was a terrible, terrible disease in those days. Salk had discovered the vaccine, and it was being used in other places, particularly in urban centers. But being from a small town in a rural county, it was not, my mother was not inoculated yet. So my mother contracted the polio virus and passed it on to me in the 7th month in utero. So I was actually born with polio. And they discovered it sometime after I was born. I had no feeling in my feet and legs, and there was some significant muscle atrophy that eventually showed up. So I was born with polio. Had my mother had the shot, the Salk vaccine, it would probably have prevented me from having it, but it didn't get out in the rural areas by then. So I had polio. I had, atrophy of weakening, withering of my legs, my lower extremities. Had that bone transplants. I have artificial left hip. Everything was involved, my legs and feet, and I didn't walk until I was 4 years old, and I learned to walk on crutches. And I did pretty well on crutches till I got up into the junior high, and I had so poor balance, and it took so long to get anywhere, I started using a chair just for expediency's sake, and I used the wheelchair from, I guess, about the time I was 14 years old to presently use one and get around in one. And people, you like to talk about the story, and other people like to talk about the story and the bravery and all this. And here's the way I look at it. When I'm in a wheelchair, I started out in a wheelchair. That is the way I live my life, crutches and a wheelchair. I've never had anything but crutches and a wheelchair, Ted. That's different than somebody who dives off a diving board in a swimming pool, cracks their neck, and they become a quadriplegic, or they get in a car wreck and they become a paraplegic, paralyzed from the waist down, and they lose what they had. To me, that is significantly more traumatic and more devastating than to be like I am and never have been able to be active. And I believe Ronnie would tell you the same thing. If Ronnie had lost his sight later in life, I believe it would have been a lot harder on Ronnie to cope with than the fact that he never had sight to start with. Doesn't mean it's not a hardship. Doesn't mean that we wish, we can't say we don't wish we didn't have the disability. But I have great compassion for someone who lost it, lost the ability to walk or lost the ability to see later in life. But, like most people, you figure out a way to overcome, and there are things you can do, there are things you can't do. You jump on your strong horse, Ted, and you ride that horse, and that's what you do in life. And that's kind of what I've done, and I don't think a lot about it. Every now and then I bump into a barrier that I just can't overcome, but for the most part, I've had a good life. I mean, I've gone more places, done more things, had more fun than just about anybody I grew up with or went to school with. Got great children, a beautiful wife. I mean, had several careers, done a lot of things that give a lot of people joy. For example, like this antenna, the other things I've done too, but it gives a lot of people a lot of joy. It lets them enjoy the hobby. So I'm happy with things. I've made mistakes. I've done things that I look back and say, boy, that was dumb. I wished I hadn't have done that, or I should have done this differently or that differently. The same regrets that most people have when they look back at certain things. But by and large, Ted, I'm okay. It's not a thing that bothers me. It's just part of me.
Well, I guess the thing I point to is the fact that so many folks, myself included, you have a bad week or a bad month, and you've got all these crazy things going on, and then you have to step back, And I'm sure that you from your perspective, you probably do the same thing. You probably step back and say, well, you know what, this isn't the ideal situation, but old so-and-so over there, he's got it a whole lot worse than I do. And, so you kind of look at that, and you also look at how people meet challenges. Somebody has had a handicap like you have with polio since you were a child, and how you meet that challenge talks to a lot of people. I mean, it speaks volumes to folks, and it should. It really, really should. Because some of us have just had it, I guess I want to say, just too easy, But my point is that when you get up in the morning, your day starts off with where the average person can get up and, they wind up, they can go across the room, grab their britches, or what if they want to go down to the local supermarket and do a bunch of grocery shopping and whatnot. Try restricting yourself to a wheelchair all day long and see how many of those activities You know, if you say, okay, I'm not going to allow myself to stand on my feet or legs, I'm going to spend the day in this wheelchair. You know, you begin to realize that what you have to fight every day that you think is so unfair is really, you know, child's play. You know, when you look at somebody that has to overcome these things. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to focus on this, but I think this is a real inspirational thing. It has been for me. I mean, and observing you and how you overcome things and how you just keep, man, you just keep trucking, you know, and the next thing you know, you got another idea sprung in your head, you know, and you're telling me all about it, and I'm thinking, I don't know. You know, but that's what I'm talking about, that fortitude, that focus, that the vitality, the vision, all those kind of things.
I am going to interrupt you and say this. I'm just like everybody else. Some days I just, you know, it's death by a thousand cuts. So some days I just lose it like every able-bodied person does. It's not every day that I'm brave and that I overcome and all that. We all define hardship as how it affects us and difficulties. So, you know, I can have a bad day, and I do have a lot of bad days. You know, I do have some challenges. Traveling is one of them. I always try to stay at the same chain of hotels or two or three chains and eat in the same places. I try not to, you know, interject wild cards into the mix where I don't know if my wheelchair will go through the door of the bathroom at this particular hotel chain or whatever. So traveling around becomes challenging, and depending on if you're out of the country, you may not have curb cuts and everything. So you have to be kind of ordered and methodical in what you do, but don't ever think, brother, that they ain't days I just like to choke a few people.
Oh no, and I understand that. What I'm talking about, though, I'm talking about the long haul. I'm talking about when you're in it for the duration, you know, because there are days that everybody gets to the point where they say, "That's it, I'm done. I ain't doing this anymore. I'm sick of this." You know, right. I mean, it happens. I mean, that's just human nature, you know. And not only am I sick of this, but I'm going to kill four people today, you know. You know, you go through that. But then that passes, and you keep trucking. Right. And the people that fall by the wayside, the folks that get out of line when they allow those things to stop them permanently, those are the ones I'm talking about that can look at you and say, hey, whoa, wait a minute. You know, this guy, he's quit 20 times this year. But he's still going. You know,
that's it.
That's the whole thing. Now, let me ask this question. How has it been, how has ham radio or amateur radio affected your ability to be involved in various businesses that involve the technical side of things?
Well, I think that any time you're doing any technical endeavor, there's transferability of skills. You're involved in a technical endeavor on a regular basis in the radio industry, in the broadcast industry, in the radio transmitter industry. Anytime you do anything technical, there's a transferability of skills. So when we're designing circuit boards, when we're figuring out circuits for controls, when we're actually producing things and using hand tools and machine tools, those skills came in very handy when my wife and I ran a food manufacturing facility there in town, for handicapped people. I think we had, maybe 150 employees. And, it was challenged with handicapped people. It was also a challenge, the manufacturing aspect of it. Keeping your skills fresh. I think if you're involved in technical things, you know, your mind's working, you're thinking about new things, better ways to do things. I think that ham radio made it is one thing, helped me not be a stay-at-home introverted person, but it forces you to talk to folks. If you squeeze that microphone, you're going to talk to people. I think that helped me. I think the technical end and the thought process of how things work and why they work and how we can make them work better. I think that it's good for anybody that's in anywhere in feel close to a technical field to be a ham and be involved in ham. And I only scratch the surface, Ted. I'm not the kind of guys that are building satellites and launching them and doing things like that. I'm an old DX guy and a rag chewer and a repeater guy and a weak signal guy, but there's some wonderful things that are being done in ham radio, in the digital arena, in the satellite arena, and other places that I'm in awe of. These guys are on the cutting edge. So I'm high on ham radio. It's helped me a lot.
We just had Chris Wilson on from Yaesu talking about their new fusion system. And I was amazed at the forethought that went into this thing, because you can talk digital on this system, or you can get out there with your Beifung, and still talk to everybody. And I really like that, because I like that into back during the day when all of a sudden all the repeaters decided they were going to go with PL tones, and so all these people are running around with these Yaesu memorizers and Drake radios, and they've got external tone encoders on them, but it's only capable of like one tone at a time, and all those PL tones came along. Now, of course, the Beifung radios have all the PL tones in them. You can do anything you want to, but the changes that have taken place, and what you're talking about, the hobby helping people stay ahead of the technology. I think that's cool. I think that's one of the best things. Let me do this. Okay. Now you've done, because of the TW2010 antenna, and I want to talk a little bit more about that, but because of the TW2010 antenna, you've been in these self-generated one-man de-expeditions. There he is out on some forlorn island somewhere with this antenna talking to people. You've had a chance to do a lot of operating, and a lot of operating where you're talking to literally thousands of people trying to get through and all this kind of stuff. So one of the things that I was wanting to do, and I don't know if we want to talk about, we may want to talk about the 2010 or the Transworld antenna lineup before we get into this, but I'd like to have you give folks, we hear so much in the way of there's books and people talk about, how to operate and things to do, but really when you get right down to it, There's probably a handful of rules, and I don't want to refer to them as rules like required rules, but five or six principles maybe that you could define to tell folks how to be successful in contesting, in terms of not, the individual contest, but in operating procedure. Because I hear train wreck stuff going on all the time. I'll tune in and I'll listen, and there's a contest going on, and these guys are like, they're not meeting up in the middle. One guy's calling us. Somebody's calling over the top of the other guy, and they don't hook up. And you hear them. You hear all this, and you think, well, and I've sat back and listened to you where you were off on some forlorn island somewhere operating with a 2010, and you were navigating through that pileup, like somebody that had been doing it all their life. So I want you to do that. But let's, and keep that in the back of your mind. Let's talk a little bit about this monobander thing that you're doing called the Horizon. I don't know much about it, but what I've heard about it sounds really interesting.
Okay, let me tell you one of the things I did in the last few years while I was off on my sabbatical from the Transworld lineup or the Transworld company is. My son and I, he did the cutting and sawing and drilling, and I did the computing and measuring, I guess. I decided, there is a need for a monoband Transworld antenna. So I developed a 10, a 12, a 15, a 17, and a 20. Now we already have a monobander and a 40, a 60, and an 80, and which has the coils in it. 40 meter, outstanding. The 60 meter, to my knowledge, is the only commercially available 60 meter antenna that's out there, other than a wire. And you know, they've just recently expanded and given more channels, more frequency space to 60 meter. Well, the TW6060 covers the original channels and the new frequencies, and it is a DX antenna on 6060. We don't sell a ton of them, Ted, but the ones that do have it are really pleased with it. And I think over time, if people got on that band and used that band, and it's on a secondary basis, so you know you may not always be able to be on the frequency you want to be on. You may have to move, but that's a good one. And the 8080, I want to come back and talk about the 8080 and ask me some questions about it. But going back to the monobander, we named it the 12, the 1010, the 1212, the 1515, the 1717, and the 2020. What these antennas are, they are the the modified H design cut to that particular frequency. They're bigger. For example, the 20 meter is the biggest. It's about around 13 feet tall. It doesn't have to be guide. It's made out of a little bigger tubing. In its center fed, it looks like the 2010. The advantage of that antenna over the 2010, a monobander over 2010, our 2010 will pretty well cover, for example, the whole general class phone band. The TW2020 will cover from 14 megahertz to 15 megahertz and below. Actually, it goes below the band. I think there's some Mars frequencies down there. It is flat SWR all the way across. It's big. People say, how much power will it handle? It'll handle more than your feed line, your regular RG8 feed line can handle. So if you get over the legal limit, Ted, that's between you and the folks down in Powder Springs, Georgia, or wherever the listening post is closest to your station. But it'll handle anything you want to throw at it. It's larger, so it has more metal in the air. You get a little better signal strength, maybe an S unit better because it's tall. And you can use a four-square system with them, Ted. You can hook four together, buy your little box. I'm going to give another plug here from DX Engineering. Set it up, and you can switch and take four of them and make them directional, just like a beam. So they are outstanding. I use the 17-meter a lot. I enjoy it, but the 10, 12, not much difference than the 2010. But as you get into the 17 and 20, you do pick up some things. And some people, they want an antenna farm, Ted, or they want to run a four-square system, or they want to run a beverage to listen on the wire, and then they want an antenna to transmit on. No radials required. No balun required. You put it up, and you take it down, and it's stealthy. It's a little bigger, but if you got trees in the yard, your neighbors aren't going to notice it. And we're putting out the line. And, you know, you asked me, I jotted some numbers down here. If my assistant will hand me. They're reasonably priced, Ted. I think you asked me a day or two ago, but the 2020 monobander's like $329. The 1010's like $199, but the 17 meter is $249.95. That is the complete antenna and the mounting pole. That's not for a stand. That's the mounting pole and the antenna. We call it the Horizon series. And if I use a TW, I've got them all in my yard. Turned that which way. Neighbors haven't complained yet, and I enjoy them. We have the, like I say, the 40, 40, 80, 80, 60, 60 in the smaller frame, you know, the smaller structure. So that's new.
Let me ask
about the Christmas gift. I'm so disappointed.
I want to ask you about the performance of the 4040 and the 8080. Now, why I'm asking this, first off, you're saying that the frame or the antenna H design is the same as the TW2010 on those two antennas. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's exactly the same size frame. The there are more coils in those. On the 4040, there's obviously more coils and longer coils. On the 8080, because of small frame, we had to put an array box on both sides. It's a double array box. The 4040, let's see, the band goes from 7.0 to 7.3. I think it has about 150 kilohertz of bandwidth on the 4040. You can set it on the low end. You can set it on the high end. You can set it in the middle. Now, that's with a flat SWR. If you want to use a tuner, you know, it's going to go up to probably 2.0 or less if you move out of the bandwidth, the 150 kilohertz bandwidth on 4040. It is outstanding, Ted. I will recommend it to anybody up against anything that's out there. Obviously, not an 8-element 40-meter beam mounted 120 feet in the air. But if you're used to using a ZEP or an inverted V or a dipole, or a vertical with ground radial, 4040 is a great antenna. Same thing with a 6060. Great antenna. You'll be tickled dead. As we get to the 8080, Ted, the laws of physics catch up with us. This is where the broadcast engineers get me. If you look at the efficiency curve on the 2010, you're up in the 90s. In other words, you're radiating, your antenna's resonating, your RF's not going up in heat. As you get up past the 60-meter band, and you at 5 to 6 megahertz, when you get down to the 3.5, 3.6, 3.7, 3.8, I think 80 is 3.5 to 4.0, the efficiency of the antenna drops. And the way we deal with that is we decrease the bandwidth, the usable bandwidth. On an 80-meter antenna that we sell, the 8080, you have 20 kilohertz of bandwidth that's flat, 1.0 to 1. It'll operate beyond that, but as it drops off quickly, so you're probably going to have somewhere around 40 or 50 kilohertz of bandwidth at 2.0 or less, then you have to use a tuner. The good thing is most people don't roam around on 80 meter. They have a standard frequency that they talk on, and that's where they kind of hang out. Their amplifiers are set there and everything. So if you use the antenna on a standard frequency and you don't leave home a lot, Ted, on that band, it's great if you live in an antenna restricted, you know, HOA situation. You don't have room on your lot for a wire. It works. What I've always wanted, Ted, I want somebody to buy one and set it down into the DX band. You know, oh shoot, let me see if I can remember the DX band. It's it's down below 3850. It's I guess it's about 3.80 is the top end of it, and that's 3.7 is the right in that window, Ted, 20 kilohertz, give or take, of 3.7, 3.8. I'd like to see somebody buy one, set it in the DX window, and see what it would do. Once again, remember the low takeoff angle. If you put up a beam, that thing will look like a pterodactyl on your house, and the rotor will probably cost $2,000 to turn it. And wires just really aren't the greatest DX antennas on that band, but I believe you can set one in the DX window in this time of year when your atmospheric noise, your static crash and everything are low in the winter months, I believe people would really work some DX with a TW8080. So once again, it's an NVIS band. You make the top arms and the bottom arms look like inverted Vs, you'll increase the bandwidth and you'll send your signal straight up and straight down. But for DX, I believe somebody's going to be the new DX king with a TW8080 in the next couple of years.
Well, we'll have to see. I know that with the antenna restrictions that people are looking at now with these HOAs, and that is out of control, ridiculous. These antennas hide. I mean, they just absolutely hide. And the one thing I do like though about the 40 meter band is the 40 meter band kind of tends to be there 24 hours a day, where 80 is not so good during the day, 20 is not so good at night, along with the bands that are like 17 and 12 and whatnot. But 40 is like, it's kind of like there all the time. Now, you usually can raise somebody on 40 meters to talk to,
right?
Any time of the day or night. So I don't know. I guess I would tend to group around 40. But I was wondering also about the bandwidth of that 40 meter antenna. How far? I know you were talking about it earlier, but let's put it this way: will it cover the general phone band in entirety on the 40 meter band without having without getting SWR so high that you would bother something?
The answer is yes. Let me restate the specs, and I don't have the band plan in front of me, but it has 150 kilohertz of bandwidth at 1.0 to 1. So the total frequency bandwidth on 40 meter is 7.0 to 7.3. So that's 300. So it will cover the bottom half, the top half, or the middle half flat. Now, you can do two things. If you're not wanting to talk DX, you can bend the top arms down like an inverted V at a 45-degree angle and bend the bottom arms up at a 45-degree angle, and you will increase that bandwidth to cover the whole band, 7.0 to 7.3. It will no longer be a super outstanding DX antenna. It will become a real good NVIS antenna. Does that help you any?
Oh yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. But I was just wondering about that, because now one thing about this antenna, but I'm not talking about the 4040. I'm talking about the TW2010. An interesting story David can tell, but he takes the antenna to the park. And I think this is kind of a cool story. You tell this now, because you don't give me a blank look.
All right, no blank looks this time.
All right, and you realize there's women listening that's going up there to look at that video. So
good looking women, David, do good.
I really enjoy my child going to bed early because he's so worn out. So in order to do that, I'll take him out to the park, and I say go play until you're just so tired that, you want to go home. And then I tell them to go play a little bit longer. But while we're doing that, I'll take my 2010 out to the park. I'll set it up with my little 817. And, actually what I do is I take the battery out of my van, and I'll just set it out there at the picnic table, hook it all up. I'll be up and running within a few minutes. I'll check the phone, see if there's any nets going on or if there's any special event stations. But I do. I'll sit out there for a good 5 hours, just listen around, making some contacts. I'll have people that'll come up to the picnic table that I'm at, and I'll be out there pretty much in a prominent area where you got some pretty heavy traffic. But a lot of people just come. They'll sit down. They'll talk with you about it. It gives you a good chance to talk about ham radio and what it is, and let them listen to let them listen to some of the contacts and see what it's all about. And I do. I have a lot of fun doing that. And, you know, it's a double bonus there, even with a child. You know, he's already tired and ready to go to sleep.
Well, I say, though, see, this antenna is already, it's ready to go. In other words, you got a carry bag that he takes it out there in, unzips the bag, pulls the antenna out, and sets it up in how long?
I mean, it's literally just a few minutes. I mean, I would say within 5 minutes, I've got the antenna up, coax run, the radio going, and it's turned on and ready to go.
So anyways, I thought that was an interesting story. For folks that like to operate portable and just operate on the fly, that I think is, I guess I want to say that is one of the very strong points of this antenna. And a lot of little portable antennas that go in a bag, I watch people set them up and then they got to tinker with them. They tinker, you know, they get them set up and it's, oh, let's see, the last time I had it on the air, it worked, you know, and you know, they're tinkering and they're trying to slide this in and slide that out and, you know, make all whatever adjustments, and they finally get it. They finally get it right, and then they're not happy with it because something else, you know, is different. But this thing here, you pull it out of the bag, open it up, and plug it in, okay? And it's done. You know, no tinkering. You don't have to sit and tinker and adjust and, you know, tweak and all that kind of thing. So anyhow, I thought it would be interesting for him to tell his story.
Ted, one of the things that I made sure of, because I operate in portable a lot and enjoy going to national parks and I won't say exotic places, but different places, the antenna does not detune when you travel. I've had the thing on airplanes hauled all over the world. And when I get there and I set it up, the wire in it, the coils in it are of such a diameter. The gauge of the wire such that you know, they can throw it around and beat it and everything else, and it does not detune. When you get there, it is tuned where it was when you left home with it. When we tune it at the factory, if somebody says we want the 8080 set on 3.980, that we want it centered there, wherever we center the antenna, unless you want to change it, you know, when, you know, one of the antennas, when you get it, you want it to do something different, it stays. It doesn't detune. And you don't have to have an antenna analyzer with you all the time to make it work. You're ready to go. When you pull it out of the bag, you set it up. 2 minutes, you're on there talking. By the time you get ready, if you set the antenna up, it'll take you longer to hook your radio up to the car battery than it will set the antenna up, Ted.
Oh, before I forget, what is the website at this point?
It's just twantennas.com, www.twantennas.com. I think www.transworldantennas.com will still take you to that, so you can key in either one of them. But when you pull it up, it says twantennas.com. And we'll probably stick with that. I'll change the web page and freshen it up over time, and we'll have specials and some other things. But that's it, www.twantennas.com.
Now, let me ask you this question, too, real quick, and that is the 2010, the TW2010, which is the 20 through 10-meter antenna that's got the little controller box. What does that antenna sell for today? I knew what it went for back whenever, but what does it go for today? And I'm talking the whole shooting match. I'm talking about somebody that wants to pick one up with a quadra stand to carry it around with them, the bag that goes, you know, the bag that folds all up in and everything. What out the door, what are these going for now?
Okay, first thing I got to do is say this is one where you get the, you know, you get one just put right over the plate and you get to really, really knock the home run in batting practice. I'm really glad you asked that question, Ted. One of the things that Gary Archer did that was different than the way I ran the company, Gary found out that not everybody is cookie cutter. Not everybody wants the same thing. So what he did was he run a grocery store. You get your shopping cart, and you can buy structure, you can buy a center section for any of the antennas. You can buy the array box, you can buy a stand, you can buy a bag. So if you go on the existing web page, and I probably won't change this, Ted. We may run some specials and have a special deal occasionally. But I think that's one of the improvements he made because, for example, some people want to mount the antenna in a yard. They're not worried about going portable. They don't want a bag. They don't need an $80 bag. They don't need a $90 stand. So everybody gets what they want. And some people, they don't need a structure. They just need a 40-40 center section to change in and out. So they put a 2010 center section in a bag or a 2010 L backpacker center section in a bag, a structure, and a 40-40, and they go off and go on vacation. So you can buy what you want. But I'll put the numbers together, and here is the total. If you wanted everything you could get for a TW2010, the antenna, that is the black powder-coated structure, the ray box, the controller, which comes with it, the stand, and the bag, the grand total, putting all those together, is $699.95. In 2010, when we launched the antenna, and we sold, I guess, 150 a month back in the day, the price of the antenna and a mounting pole was $699.95. So in 2015, a decade later, you get the total antenna system plus the stand plus the bag for $699.95.
And then, of course, you say folks can pick and choose. Now, what about the 2010L, where you don't have the remote on it, but you slide the little sliders in and out to change bands?
Yes, it is. The 2010L does not have a controller on it. The 2010L has little aluminum U-bolts with banana clips. It has 10, 12, 15, 17, and 20 holes for the top half of the antenna, the same thing for the bottom half of the antenna. So you slide in the little U-bolt with the banana clips. If you want to talk on 17 meter, you plug in 17, 17, 17 on the top, 17 on the bottom, and you're ready to go. If you want to go to any of the five bands, you don't have to power a controller. The controller, there's no relays. You change it in and out with the banana clip U-bolt. A lot of people like that. We have people that don't want all five bands. They buy that one because it's a little cheaper. You don't have to pay about, I think, whatever the controller is. You probably save about $100. And it's great. That's the one I use, Ted, when I go out and go portable. I use a 2010L. We call it the backpacker. That may be a little bit of a stretch because the thing weighs about 18 pounds. So you got to have a pretty strong back to carry it around too far. But the bag does have straps on it, and you can actually carry it like a backpack. But that's that one. One of the things we're hoping for, Ted, is to put a USB port on the control box with a circuit board, using a circuit board, and let you use an external power supply like you recharge a cell phone, plug that into the back of the controller, and there wouldn't really be a need for a 2010L unless you just wanted to save the money. It's only 200 milliamps to open and close the relays on a 2010. So, really a 9-volt battery would do that. It would just be how long would it work? We had the engineer do the numbers for me, so you could almost keep one turned on indefinitely and probably switch back and forth for 12, 15 hours before, a real good battery pack would go dead. So that's one of the innovations I hope to make is make the controller easier to power. Of course, now most people power it off the radio, or they will power it off the car battery or whatever. They have they run the radio off of a power supply. They use the power supply for to power the controller. But I just think it would be neat to have a little external battery pack about the size of a deck of cards, just to plug in that USB port and be out in the middle of nowhere using a 2010 and be lazy and not have to get up and walk over and change those banana clips.
There you go. We're out of time. We are out of time.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but I wanted to do one thing, though, real quick, and I'll make you do it quick because I think you've got some points that can be used by folks. Give us, like, you know, five main tips that you've discovered working this antenna on D-Expeditions and whatnot. Five main tips for folks to follow that will ensure that they do much better during contesting.
Well, the first thing I would say is this. Be courteous. There is more than enough bandwidth on the ham frequencies on all bands. You don't have to fight over frequency space. If somebody's using a frequency, or there's a net coming up and they ask you to move, be courteous. Move. Go to a different frequency. Don't fight over frequency. I mean, come on, guys. There's more frequency than we'll all ever use in our lifetime. So be courteous. Be respectful. Do it that way. The second thing is, if you're working a contest or you're working a D-Expedition, don't always answer the strong station. There's a lot of guys out there running QRP, or they don't have the big gun stations. Answer a few of the guys that are weak that you can barely hear. They may be mobile. They may be QRP. Give everybody a chance to work you. The third thing I would say is, let the caller decide what you're going to do. If all he wants is the call sign and signal report, okay, he's got you. He's in the log. If a guy calls in and he's waited an hour or two to talk to you, and he's been where you've been, or he knows something about the location you're at, or he wants to ask you a question about your operating conditions, what is a minute or two to talk to a guy? Why run him off or be rude or turn him over real quickly? Come on. Isn't that what it's about? It's about communication. It's about having fun. It's about enjoying the hobby or avocation. And I think, Ted, it's important to follow up with a QSL card. There's a lot of people like to send and receive cards. Once again, be courteous. If you want a card from somebody, put an envelope in there, put a stamp on it, put your card in there, and let the guy just drop a card in and send it back. A lot of hams don't have a lot of funds. And D-Expeditions cost a lot of money. If you want a card, hey, drop the price of a postage stamp envelope, send him a card, get a card back. And if you are working a special event or contest, make sure you get your stuff out timely. I mean, it's more fun to get your certificate or get your card within a few weeks than wait a year, get it a year later. Those are just some thoughts off the top of my head, Ted. I mean, other people may have different thoughts or do things different ways. That doesn't mean I'm right and they're wrong, or they're right and I'm wrong. But I think those general guidelines will make people enjoy operating, be a whole lot more fun for them.
Well, we are officially out of time. David, any final comments you've got from your corner over there?
Just thank you very much for your hostile takeover of the company, and I look forward to seeing any new ideas that you come up with this antenna.
Poor Gary, we've worked him over tonight talking about hostility.
If we do get into hostilities, I'll send a picture of me and Gary, and you can post it on your webpage, Ted, and see which one of us came out looking the worst.
Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Dr. Michael Barrett, N4 ECW. I want to say 73s to everyone out there listening. We'll be back, same station, same time, same podcast, wherever you're listening. And We just want to thank you very much for joining us right here for QSO Live on WTWW. Well, that's all the time we've got for the QSO Radio Show today. We want to say a special thank you to our guest, Dr. Michael Barrett of Trans World Antennas. And we want to invite you back next week, same time, same station, for another QSO Radio Show 73's.